Evening, everybody. Welcome back to That's Criminal with John Stamp. Before I get started, a reminder, anybody who likes, subscribes, and rates the TCP is going to get a free ebook. You hit me up by DM on Instagram at That's Criminal Podcast or email John at johnstampwriter.com, and I will send you one of my titles, either Brother's Keeper, Shattered Circle, or Wraith of Sheltermount. Tonight, I am very excited to talk to best-selling author of multiple crime series, novellas, and short stories, and host of the Wrong Place, Right Crime podcast, Frank Zaffiro. Frank served in the U.S. Army as a linguist. In 1993, he became a police officer in Spokane, Washington. During his career, he did time as a patrol officer, corporal, detective, and then promoted into leadership roles, become a sergeant. In 2002, he had the good fortune to command not only patrol, but investigators, canine, and the SWAT team. He also commanded full divisions, patrol and investigations at different points in his career until retiring in 2013 as a captain so that he could write full time and teach in both the criminal justice and writing fields. Side note, that is the dream. Frank primarily writes gritty crime fiction from both sides of the badge, which is very interesting. This includes his River City series and his Spoke Compton series. His storytelling creed is that the good guys usually win, but not always and never without a cost. Same here. Frank is out of Redmond, Oregon, where he lives with his wife, Christy. And Frank, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yep. I like we were talking about earlier, I found Under the Raging Moon and not to, you know, not to to try and be a little too mushy up front, but I immediately got that that Wamba feel of the way you had all those different cop personalities and the cop roles all mixed up together right out of the gate. I mean, we start with a nice fun way to end night shift. Well, not fun for everybody. And switch and go right into roll shift where night shift and day shift are talking trash. And it just goes from there. And I could see people I'd worked with throughout my career, in that roll call room. So off to a great, I enjoyed it. I'm still on Under the Raging Moon, but your newest release is Ride Along. When I found that, can we look at how you came about doing that? There's obviously really current need for a discussion like that, but this Ride Along pits a reformer with a longtime police officer stuck in the same car for a shift. How did that come about?
Well, I should be clear that these are two separate series. Under a Raging Moon is the kickoff of the River City series. The Ride Along is the fifth book in the Charlie 316 series. The difference really is that River City I write by myself, the Charlie 316 series I co-author with my friend and colleague Colin Conway. We wrote a four series arc in that first in that Charlie 316 book, the series rather. The first four books kind of completed a character arc. We call it the Tyler Garrett arc. For those who read the first book, you'll know what that means. But once we finished that, we had created such a cool universe to play in that we talked about it. And we're like, you know, just because this arc is done with, you know, we could still have books that take place in this series that could kind of stand alone. And so we had a couple of ideas we were kicking around. Meanwhile, I was frustrated with sort of the two separate things at once. I was frustrated with a public that was very critical and often not very knowledgeable about law enforcement and jumped to conclusions and painted people with one broad brush. And really, there was always a rush to judgment, it felt like. And so that was very frustrating because I worked in the field for over 20 years, and I met not only people from my own agency, but in my role as a national instructor, I met people from all over the country in their own environment. And I nothing ever shook my belief and understanding that the majority of law enforcement professionals are dedicated people who work hard, who are trying to do as well as they can at a very difficult and increasingly difficult job. And so I kind of bristled at this, you know, this, the way the public was reacting to things. At the same time, I was a little frustrated with our profession, because not only because sometimes they were just, there were individuals who were bad actors, who were just out and out doing wrong things, making mistakes or being purposefully malicious. That's bad enough. But I also felt like we'd made some strategic errors over the decades, you know, like back to about the 1970s, that have put us in a position where we're very much at odds with our communities. And so there's an estrangement there, and we don't do ourselves any favors. I mean, we don't explain ourselves very well. We don't present ourselves well in some cases. And so both of those things were frustrating me. And then the larger frustration was neither side, if you will, or nobody from anywhere on the spectrum seemed to be really talking to each other. Everybody was shouting their slogans, arguing in sound bites. If you got somebody who seemed like they were listening, they were probably just preparing their counterpoint. I mean, there's no real dialogue taking place. It was just very frustrating. And so I, a little wish fulfillment, I guess, I created a situation where two characters had no choice but to listen to each other. And the idea began as a short story. Initially, I envisioned it as just a short story, where this veteran law enforcement officer and a police reformer were in the same car for 10 hours. And my thought was to put two good people who had very different beliefs in this setting. And real quickly, I realized it was too big of an idea for a short story. It wouldn't be the same. So it ended up breaking out into being more of a novel, and ultimately a pretty long novel. It's about 90,000 words, I think. And you know, so that was the genesis of it. But originally it was just going to be a standalone that I was writing. And I got kind of stymied about a quarter of the way into it, because I was not able to, there was no locality to the story. It was Anytown, USA. And so while I could talk about either specifically or in general national events and trends, I couldn't get the emotion that goes with a local crisis, a local scandal, local tragedy, a local disagreement.
Yeah, like something that's affecting the community at the time.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. Spokane, Washington, where I did my career and where I lived for most of my life, there was a reaction there to, for instance, George Floyd, that whole situation and his death. But there was a much bigger reaction in Spokane to events that happened locally. Anybody in Spokane, if I say Otto Zem, there's a very visceral reaction, and it's more visceral than something that happened at the national level because it's closer to home. And I wasn't getting that in the telling of this story. And so I realized I needed to put it somewhere. And long story short, I went through quite a process trying to figure out where it fit. I realized that it fit best in the Charlie 316 universe. So I reached out to Colin, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. We did it a little differently than we normally did. Usually we brainstorm, outline, and then write together in a certain process. But in this instance, I wrote the first draft, and then we did the revisions together. And he brought a lot to the table and really made it a much better, much more balanced book. Because the important piece here is that neither person is a straw person for the other. Like the reformer isn't there so the cop can look great and knock down all of her ideas. And then you get my point. The cops are right, you know, and the cop isn't there to look like every cliche, every cop, everywhere. And for her to make her points and knock down his arguments and for her to look great. It's two good people who have good reasons to believe what they believe, both intellectually and experientially, who don't really want to listen to each other at first, but ultimately, as you pointed out in the introduction, they do have to listen to each other.
Yeah. So it's not a lecture. It's a you know, social commentary through the eyes of each side, which I don't think I've ever actually seen a discussion of that that's outside of a 2-minute soundbite, one way or the other. And it's all, like you said, it's just dropping lines and trying to fly your flag. And neither side, when they're getting the exposure, is very intelligent on either one of them, either matter. So yeah, that's such a good way to offer that conversation. One of the questions I come up with is, if I'm not mistaken, Colin is also law enforcement, you're law enforcement. Did you need a buffer or a filter? Did you need somebody to bounce ideas off of to make sure you guys weren't flying one way or the other, turning it into a lecture? How'd you keep it balanced?
Well, part of it was being extraordinarily conscious of it and really always checking yourself. Is that, you know, am I being fair here, and getting into the skin of whichever person was, making the point, or whoever's point of view it was for that chapter, making sure that we were representing both people as accurately and fairly as possible. Colin was a cop for about 5 years. And so while he understands police culture and he was part of it, he's been a businessman far more of his life. And he's been away from law enforcement much longer than I have been. And so really he was a big part of the check and balance on that. And then, yeah, we did reach out to other people that we know during the beta period, the reader period of revisions, and specifically ask them, you know, if you feel like, you know, this is too pro-police or this is too anti-police, or this person is being disingenuous or being presented in a way that isn't fair, you know, tell us, because this is we wanted it to be as close as 50-50, as close to 50-50 as possible, which is of course impossible because we all have our own biases, and even unconscious biases obviously are going to come into play. The worst criticism or the worst estimate, I guess, that I've heard from any readers has been 60-40, that we tended to lean towards law enforcement more than the other viewpoint, on about a 60-40 split. Most have been much closer to 50-50. And of course that was our goal. Mm-hmm. But the point you bring up is excellent. And it was definitely on our mind the entire time we were writing it.
Yeah. And I wonder, and this would, you know, with you coming from the PD, did this rub anybody the wrong way coming from the background?
You know, I've been retired since 2013. I think I'm so far off the radar of people at my department that are still doing the job that I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, Frank, I remember him. Like, if I come up, that's probably the reaction. Aside from a few people who are readers and fans of my work. So, no, I haven't gotten any negative feedback. And I wouldn't expect to necessarily, because our goal really was, no matter where you were on the spectrum, whether you were moderate or you were on the fringes of either viewpoint, and that's of course simplifying things a lot. It's not just one viewpoint or the other, but wherever you were on the spectrum, if you read this book, there'd be times where you'd be like, yes, I'm so glad that got said, that in your face, that's exactly what we're talking about, you know? And then there'd be times where you would be like, oh no, what, you know, come on, that's ridiculous, you're stupid, you know, this visceral reaction there. But that there'd also be times, regardless of where you were, where you might go, huh, you know, I never really thought of it that way before. I never really looked at it that way before. And then maybe they would agree to think about it a little bit. I mean, even if that's all we did, that was a success. But so far, yeah, nobody's showed up with pitchforks and torches over it, for sure.
and those that would probably be the least educated on the topic. But it's funny.
Well, the most extreme reaction usually does come from the least knowledgeable.
Yep. And it's funny. I left the PD a long, long time ago, but I'm to the point where my coworkers are retiring, and we'll get together and have those conversations between, you know, intelligence led policing of today. If we'd have been able to kind of spearfish those communities and just specifically target by action, instead of, I don't know how it worked, probably the same way in Spokane, you know, if there was issues in a particular block, and kind of going hard, you know, flooding, they called it back in the day. And like you said, that would often do a lot of damage, because there'd always be somebody caught in the middle that probably shouldn't have been there. And we just think of all the technology and all the resources that we could have today to go at it in a more surgical way than we did when we were, and I'm not saying we did it wrong back in the day. I'm just saying that, you know, 20 years gives you some time to think about how could we have done this, you know, a little more surgical and precise. But
yeah, we often used a machete when a scalpel would have been a better tool.
Yeah,
but one of the things people don't really stop and think about when they're critical of the police and is that the police are, you know, they're part of an ecosystem. You know, I mean, they operate within a municipal or county organization as well, and they operate within the community that they're part of, and all of these things exert influence on the police department. It's not it doesn't operate in a vacuum, and so that's why solving issues like this are, you know, it's not I've got the solution, here it is, and we're done. It's a much more difficult process.
Yeah, you can't solve community-wide problems with slogans and votes. It's I always came down to me that every failure, every criminal that we find is the fault of the community. You know, so it's, but you'll have, you know, people on one side of the city saying one thing, the people on another side of the community blaming something else, and the people in the middle blaming everybody else. But if, you know, I always thought that if we looked at it, like every time we created somebody who could not survive in society, if we shared that responsibility, what would, you know, what discussions would come out of that? But, you know, I'm far from an expert. I just, it's just unfortunate when you see really intelligent people that end up swept up in the system. And sometimes they just didn't see what the opportunities were, you know, what the other avenues were. But
honestly, it's that type of person that I kind of got me writing about writing books about those kinds of people, when I wasn't writing, you know, police related fiction, when it says gritty crime fiction from both sides of the badge, that's the other side, the underside. Right. And it's interesting to write these characters who are, the characters that, you know, my police characters would have arrested and chased and hunted for and so forth, and write them in a way that hopefully the reader can understand and sympathize with them and their reality, because, you know, everybody's the hero of their own story, and everybody has a reason for kind of why they are the way they are. And sometimes understanding that and being a little bit compassionate about it, it helps you resolve these problems. And of course, you know, that's a little bit kumbaya. I realize that. And, but I'm retired now. I'm not staring at calls stacking up on the screen or, you know, a bunch of cases to work on. So I can be a little bit more optimistic.
Yeah, right. Right. And that reference to the Spoke Compton series, with the River City series, loosely based on Spokane, Spoke Compton, in that same universe, that, and the other new book, the Jack McCrae, mysteries, all of those, I mean, the strategic, way you must go after or plan out your characters and your stories is something I'm still trying to wrap my mind about. I mean, I'm working my way through. I always start with an author's first book. But as I'm, you know, doing my research, getting ready to talk to you, I'm like looking and I'm like, this is intense. I mean, there's a like 1, 2, 3, 4, what is it? 3, 5, 7, 9.
40 counting.
Yeah. Oh, 40 yeah, and count. Yeah. 9 series wrapped up in relatively the same universe, correct?
Well, there's really 3 separate universes, to be fair. The easiest one to cut off and get rid of in terms of overlap is the Charlie 316 universe. That's its own thing, but it is set in Spokane and it, you know, it has that same setting. And then there's the River City universe, which is the bulk of, you know, has the most books in it. And there's a spinoff series from that, a character who is in the River City series that you already have encountered in the first book, Stefan Kopriva. I guess spoiler alert, he leaves the department at some point, and there's a private detective series, basically an unlicensed PI series called the Stefan Kopriva Mysteries, that also take place and overlap heavily with the River City series. It's So much so that I almost folded it into the series and made it a part of the main series. But I resisted that with the Capriva books because they're PI books and I thought they needed to be separate. Everything else takes place in the Spocompton universe. So Spocompton books, the and the Jack McCrae mysteries, and the Sandy Banks thrillers, they of which there's only one so far, but those all take place in the Spocompton universe. So it's been, you know, you got kind of got to keep it straight and everything. I've got a couple of spreadsheets to keep characters straight on the River City series, but it does allow you to do different things and have different focuses. I mean, the River City series, that focuses on the police officers and the detectives mostly. I mean, I get into leadership a bit, but for the most part, it's about people that are pushing the cruisers or working a case file, you know, where the rubber meets the road. And the cops are the heroes in these stories. I mean, they're not infallible. They're not Dudley Do-Right. They're not Sir Lancelot. They're flawed, real human beings, but they're heroic in their intent. And so that's how that series is written, and that's where the focus is on that. And since Copriva's from that world, he's in that world as well, since he's from that series. The Spocompton universe is a little darker and grittier. And while the cops aren't the bad guys in that universe per se, they are the bad guys according to some of the protagonists, you know, that they would view the cops that way. And the cops they tend to interact with are not necessarily the greatest ones. They, you know, they interact with the surlier or even corrupt ones. Well, I wouldn't say corrupt necessarily in most cases, but certainly not. The chief of police would not approve of how they're talking to the protagonist.
Yeah, feeding their stereotype, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first book is in the Spocompton series. You've got a guy that got bounced off the job and is making his living for a long time as an under the radar fence. And the second book's about the outlaw biker gang, you know, third book's about another cop who left the job in disgrace and is a PI. And then the fourth one that will come out in October is about a pint-sized burglar that she's taking care of her addict brother. The furthest thing from say Katie McLeod, who is kind of the core character ultimately in the River City series. I mean, they share a gender and that's about it, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty far afield from each other.
Yeah, and I was wondering, you mentioned you got a couple of spreadsheets that keep you kind of on track, but I was wondering if the picture of you with an entire whiteboard of a wall and just like you're just having a battle board with like different colors marking out the pathways of all your different characters. I was like, how does he do this?
I should.
Yeah. Cause I was thinking of Stefan's character. Cause like you said, I just met him. He's young cop. He's the guy that is going to foot pursue every guy he comes into, even though he's out, you know, outweighs him because he's 30 pounds heavier with a vest and a gun belt and the boots, all that stuff. He's still going to go get him. How do you plan for that, Stefan, and to have him leave the department? I mean, no spoilers, of course. And then kick off doing his own PI thing. Like, how far in advance do you plan that out?
Well, now I plan it out quite a bit. Like, I know where certain characters are going to be 5 or 6 books from now. And so the nice part about that is, in the River City series, is that I'm laying little hints and little foundational pieces, in the books that I'm writing now, so that when we get 5 or 6 books from now and those things happen with those characters, it's fair to the reader. It's not going to be a surprise at all. It's like, oh, I should have saw that coming. Or the more astute reader will be like, I knew that was going to be where she was going to end up, or what he was going to do, or whatever. And then with the other series, I think I am not planning 5 or 6 books ahead, but I'm usually 2 or 3 ahead in where things are going to go. The Copriva thing is a little different. I mean, I wrote the first four books in, I would say, about a 5-year period, pretty much back, almost back to back to back. And I didn't have any other series I was working on. This was the, these were the only novels I was working on for the most part, in addition to short stories. And so I knew where the first, I envisioned it as a 4-book series. That was as far as I thought it was going to go. And avoiding spoilers, you know, at some point during those 4 books, Kopreva leaves the agency, and, you know, these books start in 1994. And when I catch up, and they're about a year apart each. I mean, the 4th book takes place in 98. So there's just a 4-year period there for those 4 books. When you catch back up with Kopreva, it's 2005. So I jumped ahead almost a decade. And when I wrote that first Kopreva mystery novel, now, of course, that, since then I've caught up and lapped those books, you know, I mean, it's to the point now where if somebody wants to read all of River City, Kopreva and River City, you know, you kind of got to blend in the chronology of it and figure out what, you know, what happens when. And I've created a chart for readers to be able to take at a glance, be able to see, if they're just reading River City or if they want to read both, River City and Kopreva, which book is in which order. And there's some benefit to that. I mean, characters grow and change and big events happen. But realistically, any one of these books also stands alone. And there's anything you need to know about the past, I'll refer to and give you enough information in each book so that you've got it. That's just good. That's just good writing. I mean, that's just good strategy. People shouldn't be required to pick up the first book. I mean, I didn't. One of my favorite writers is Steve Hamilton. And I picked up his Alex McKnight book with book number 3, The Hunting Wind. And I read it and I didn't even realize it was part of a series when I started it. And then I was like, oh, there's two before this. So I went back and read those. And that's happened. I've had plenty of people come and say, hey, I just read, you know, book 4 and I didn't know it was book 4. And so now I'm going to go back and read the rest of the series. But I do think reading it in order is a much richer experience. I mean, you get to see these characters grow and change, and there's a wedding scene and a retirement scene that kind of bookends the next River City book that I'm releasing in September. And both of those events are far more powerful and bittersweet if you've read the entire series. There's a lot more emotion packed into them because you've, you know, driven those miles with those characters, and so you feel what they're feeling. Certainly you get it if it's the first book you pick up, but you really get it if you've read the whole series.
Yeah, especially if it's one of those ones where you get that vibe 2 books prior to, and it's like, oh, I knew they were gonna hook up. Yeah, finally you get that.
I mean, the characters that get married are there. Yeah, they've been dealing with that for since the 5th book, you know, I mean, so you're absolutely right.
Yep. Now with all the planning and the arcing of the characters, is there any particular character that stole the show from you? Like, you start out with a plan and he or she is like, yeah, I don't want, I'm going to go my way. And you just end up having to scrap and just watch where they go.
You know, not entirely scrap, but, you know, in that first book that you're reading, I thought Stefan Kopreva was going to be the star of the series, like for 4 books, and in the back of my head, if it went longer, right? And he was kind of the avatar character. I mean, I can say this now because I'm much older and I can look back at my, I mean, I wrote that first draft in 1995. So how old was I? You know, I mean, definitely 25 years younger than I am now.
Two years on the job.
And so, I had 2 years on the job. I knew everything. I could handle everything. Everybody that, you know, all my senior officers were stupid and all that, you know, all the arrogance that comes with that. But all the excitement too. All the excitement of being a cop and doing that job and seeing firsthand the impact that you can have, the positive impact that you can have. And so when I wrote that Kopreva character, you know, I wouldn't have admitted it then, but it's easy to look back and say, yeah, he was kind of an avatar character to a degree for me. I mean, he was an idealized version of what I'd like to be like all the time. And then, you know, molded as I needed for the story, but he was that vessel, I guess, character for me at the beginning. And then when I realized, and then he kind of, the reason he leaves the job kind of just happened, and I realized I was wrong, and he wasn't going to be that character. Conversely, the character of Katie McLeod was originally two separate characters. One was written as a love interest, essentially, for Kopriva, and the other one had an arc of dealing with self-doubt in the face of a near failure on the job and overcoming that, and as well as incorporating the idea of being a woman in what it was still, and what actually still is to a degree, a male dominated field, at least in numbers. And so they were two separate characters and two separate shifts and everything. And one of the things I realized writing that book is, you know, you've probably gone, wow, there's a lot of people to keep track of as you're reading it. Yeah, there were probably twice as many initially, you know. I whittled them down. Instead of creating a new character, I gave jobs to an existing character, and I worked really hard to try to narrow it down as far as possible. And one of the things that was really clearly on was that neither of these two characters that I've mentioned were strong enough on their own. They were just too cardboard and not quite there. And as part of the let's make it have fewer characters effort during one revision, I decided, well, these could be the same character. Why can't this woman who's going through this crisis early on in her career of a near failure and wondering about that and dealing with being a woman in a man's field, why can't she also be involved, you know, become involved with Kopriva and have a relationship with him? And so it was a happy accident that they were combined into Katie McLeod, but she was still a secondary character. And even in the second book, she remains a secondary character, as you'll see, although she has a very important event in that second book to contrast with something Kopriva goes through. But by the third book in the series, Katie McLeod has emerged as the core character, as between her and the veteran character of Thomas Chisholm.
Yep.
Those two were the core of the series for a long time, and Katie remains the core. I mean, she's the point of view character for the Worst Kind of Truth, which will be out in September. And she's kind of come to personify River City for me. If I think of River City, she's the first character I think of.
Wow. And so that just kind of organically, like with your, so here's your, like when I outline, I get a ending to the book and a beginning of the book, and I can work my way from A to Z somewhat while I'm going. I got an outline to get me there, but I can move and I can stick and move if I need to, as long as I get to where I want to finish. So I'm guess I visualize this as you, instead of plotting one book, you plot five. And then as it grows, book one, book two, organically, is it kind of one of those things where this particular lotto ball is the one that's going up the pipe, and it just happens to be Katie instead of Kopernik, or just happens to be, you know, Winters or Chisholm. Just as you saw this world building, was it like, did you just see the avenue for her look stronger?
Yeah, she interested me the most ultimately because, and I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, so
yeah,
bear with me, but no, it's not you. It's, I mean, I could explain it a little easier with spoilers, but ultimately what Katie, you know, Thomas Chisholm represents the old guard, right? I mean, he was a Vietnam veteran. He's 14 years on the job when the series starts. He's a fount of wisdom. He's Wyatt Earp. You know, he is not ruffled by situations. He gives good advice. He cares about his fellow officers. He's a peer leader. He's not a positional leader. He's not a sergeant, but he's he leads his peers by, example and by caring for them. And so that was one sort of character. And Chisholm is a huge part of this series. He even has his own book after he retires at one point called Chisholm's Debt. But Katie was exciting to me for another reason, and that is that she was not afraid to admit to herself her own doubt, her own fears, and even admit when she has failed or made a mistake. But in spite of all of that, she also rose to the occasion every time. She wasn't afraid to battle. She wasn't afraid to say, I'm afraid of this situation and I'm going to do it anyway. I failed at this, but I'm going to get back up on that horse anyway. And that tenacity, while still being honest and vulnerable, really grew on me. And I think it's a healthy way for somebody to go through a career, because machismo and you know, tombstone courage and all that doesn't really work in the long run. And it's probably inadvisable. And she didn't have that. She had true courage, right? I mean, she was afraid and did it anyway. And she always ran towards danger, not away from it. So, I mean, she did the things that are brave that a cop should do. But it was realistic in that she felt the emotions and she struggled with the things she struggled with. And she's not perfect. I mean, she's gotten frustrated with things and she's made mistakes. But she never gives up and she never quits and she never surrenders to cynicism to the degree that it affects her ability to do her job honorably. And so as the, you know, series has progressed, she's just kind of become the torchbearer for the series. She's become the core of it. Her and Chisholm, until Chisholm eventually retires as time goes on. And then she's kind of taken up the torch from there. She's just plus it doesn't hurt that she's a strong female character, and a lot of readers out there are women who, you know, they don't always get strong female characters. They sometimes get a female character ostensibly who's really just a dude in pumps, you know, a guy in a skirt sort of character, right? Change the pronouns and we're good sort of approach. And I don't dig that. I don't think that's fair. I want her to be, you know, a true strong female character. And so anyway, I'm rambling on because she's really become the core of my series and my favorite character.
Yep. Yeah. And I always ask that because I've had a couple books where just the characters, I got it all mapped out. It's looking great. And the characters just they're not jiving with the plot, and it mm-hmm. it changes mm-hmm. and it's character driven changes. And but mm-hmm. To be able to capture, you know, that those moments after the adrenaline wears off and you actually process what just happened and you're like, that was a little closer than it should have been, you know, to be able to capture that in a character is a hard thing to explain. So that's her character is just really honest, I think. So
That's a good way to put it. That is, she is very honest and always tries to be very honest with herself and with other people.
Yep. And that kind of leads into building on how these characters come up and how they interact with each other. The idea of, for me, like I there's a ton of people who collaborate and a ton of people who have that writing partner. And it might be just because of I'm not that developed or experienced yet. But when I try to think about that, I have a hard time trying to, you know, I write my half, you write your half, and they blend. How do you go about writing with a partner?
I've done it a couple of different ways, and the way we, Colin and I, do it now is, I think, the best way. But initially, the majority of the books that I've written with other authors, we elected to use a dual first-person narrative with alternating chapters. And so if you and I were doing that, then we would have two protagonists that we're writing about. And I would write chapter one from the point of view of my protagonist, and I would use first person. So I went to the store, I picked up some milk, so forth. The end of my chapter two is from the point of view of the character that you're writing. And you would also write in the first person and everything. So you get two very distinct voices. And really, when you do that, we're each writing half a book. We're not, you know, it's not quite the same as writing a whole book. And now during the editing process, you know, you may edit heavily each other's work or not. That's something you have to decide as partners, as collaborators. I've done it both ways. There's been some people I've collaborated with where we kind of took an advisory role on editing the other person's chapters and then edited our own really hard. But I think you get the best book when both partners have absolute authority to edit hard, entirety of the book. What Colin and I do now, and this first started when I was working with Larry Kelter on a couple of books, is we map it out like you're talking about, how you have a beginning and an end. We start there, and then we get a pretty good map of the entire book. It might, you know, be just a line for a particular chapter. You know, John discovers that, you know, Frank is secretly a Mason. Boom, you know, and that's the chapter. It might be a snippet of dialogue. It might be, you know, a paragraph or whatever, but just so we've got an outline to work from. And then we've kind of gotten to the point pretty quickly where we divide up the characters. And so, for instance, in Charlie 316, I think we're telling people this. I hope I'm not spilling the beans, but like I wrote the character of Wardell Clint, and Colin wrote the character, and Colin wrote the chapters of Tyler Garrett from his point of view, and which means nothing to you if you haven't read the book, but they're two pretty pivotal characters. And so if there's a couple of chapters that pop up that are characters that I need to write, I write those two chapters or three or whatever, or one. And then I send that first draft to him. He takes a look at that. Let's just say it's one chapter. He takes a look at that chapter. He goes through and does a line edit on it, a first pass line edit. And then he goes in and writes his chapter. When he sends it back to me, I've got chapter one and two now, right? I go in and look at his line edits and accept, reject, discuss, whatever, work on them, go in and do line edits on his second chapter and write my chapter three. And then that process continues back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until we get to the end of the first draft and have cleaned up every one of those line edits, either by accepting the edit or discussing it and resolving it or making whatever changes need to be made or whatever. And the benefit of that is that really when you get to the end of draft 1.0, you're at least at 1.5, if not 2.0. And then when we go into the editing process, we kind of, I wouldn't say flip a coin, but we decide one way or another for various reasons, who's going to go first. And we just take a hard pass at the entire book. And we have permission to treat it like you wrote the whole thing. There are no sacred cows. Change whatever you want. Because we use track changes. So I can see if the other person changed. And then whoever starts it sends it to the other person. You go through and you accept whatever changes you agree with. And, you know, discuss the ones that you don't and make any additional ones that you want to make. And we go back and forth that way until we've got either arguably 3.0 or whatever. And then obviously from there it goes out to beta readers and comes back, and we do the same process again with somebody taking a pass, somebody, you know, and then passing it back and forth. The benefit of this is, you know, if you have permission to change anything, then, you know, it's going to be a better book than if you're only changing the portions that you wrote. And it's been a really good process for us. But it requires trust, right? You have to know, you know, I have to know that when you made that edit, it was because you thought that's what's best for the book, not because you thought, I'm going to show you, I'm a better writer than you, or you changed mine in the last chapter. So I'm going to change. I mean, you have to,
no paybacks.
You can't have that. You have to check your ego at the door, literally, and trust each other. And so, I mean, I sometimes equate it to a marriage in some ways, in that you have to have that trust and you have to want to do what's best for the project, not what's necessarily just best for you.
Yeah. Hear the hard truths. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And we've been fortunate in that I don't think we've ever had And I mean, we've written 6 books together. I don't think we've ever had any arguments, I guess. I mean, we've had, you know, discussions that were animated, and we've gotten like excited, and we've disagreed, and but it's always been, it's not personal. It's about, you know, I mean, it could be somebody else's book we're editing and we'd have the same argument or same discussion. And so I think some of my best work has come from those collaborations because of that process.
And you mentioned something earlier, cause I had a question about tone, because it seems like you really got to be in sync to keep that right tone flowing through that book. You mentioned, you know, kind of cycling through it. So you take chapters 1 and 2, he takes a look at it and then refreshes himself on that edit. And then he takes 3 and 4 and then you refresh. So I was wondering how two people can keep that same sync, and that kind of went a long way, but I was wondering, have you ever run into a point where the tone is off, where there's just a change between the overall flavor of one writer's pages to another? And have you ever had to deal with that change?
Not in the finished product. I mean, as you go through it, you know, we're two different writers. I mean, if you read Collins, the closest thing to Charlie 316 would be his 509 series of police procedurals. And the closest thing that I write would be the River City series. If you were to read the River City series and then read Charlie 316, it would have a different voice to it. It would have a different tone. If you read the 509 and then you read Charlie 316, same thing. And so it does crop up in those early drafts. What beats it out of this of the manuscript basically is that editing process where we're both working on it to where Charlie 316 has its own third distinct voice. It's not Frank, it's not Colin, it's I don't know, you know, it's whatever that combination of us is. It's Frank Conway, it's Colin Zafiro, whatever. I mean, it's its own thing. You know, it's you know, one of those things where you get a third voice. And I mean, I had that happen even more radically with the Lawrence Kelter book that we wrote in the first person called The Last Caller. When he reached out to me and said, "Hey, I want to write a procedural and I want to work with you because, you know, I want to bring that experience to it." And he was never a cop. And I told him about that dual first person stuff that I'd been doing. And he was like, "Yeah, that's great, but I don't want to do that." I was like, "Oh, okay. What do you want to do?" Okay. And he's like, "Well, we can do first person, but let's just do one voice." And I was seriously, I had some serious reservations about it. I almost didn't do it, to be honest with you. Because I was afraid of exactly what you're talking about, especially in the first person, that I essentially people, we might as well write a schizophrenic detective because that's how he's going to sound. Yeah. And, but we took a very similar editing process. I don't think we did it while we wrote. I think we just wrote the chapters, but when we went back and edited it, we did it very similar to what eventually developed into the process Colin and I use. And we edited it very hard, and everybody had full permission. Both of us had full permission to edit everything. And I'll be honest with you, at this point, if I were to pick that book up and open it up and, you know, pick 3, 4, or 5 random passages, I would be hard pressed to tell you if I wrote that passage or if I just edited it. You know, there might be 1 or 2 tells, like phrases that I, you know, that sneak in that I use, little writer tells, but for the most part, it's a third voice. It's not either of our voices. And I couldn't even tell you which part I originated with me and which part I just edited. And that's the beauty of that trust, of that. You can edit it any way you want, and I will accept that you've edited it that way. I may disagree and we'll argue about it, but I know you did it because it's the best thing for this project.
Yeah, as long as the primary goal is the best piece of paper you can get. But two writers, one character, that's daunting. Like that's
it was.
Yeah, that's a lot of cooperation. But yeah, I guess I can see you know, that wash, the second wash, third wash, will bring you in line a bit. But yeah, you got to have a unity of vision to go forward to just get started. But yeah, that's a lot of coordination. But yeah, I noticed that throughout your series, the amount of people that you've written with, that was a question that kind of coordination I haven't been able to wrap my head around yet. So yeah, but it makes sense.
Well, it's different every time though, John. You know, I mean, when I wrote with Eric Buettner, I mean, aside from that, that was one of those situations where we each wrote our piece and we made a few comments on the other person and maybe anything that was a continuity issue or hey, can we change this to this because of that, you know, that kind of stuff. Other than that, it was light editing on both our parts when it came to the other person's work. Part of the reason is because Buettner writes such an incredibly clean first draft, to be honest with you, but that was a completely different experience. It wasn't, and it was a great experience, but it wasn't as heavy of an editing, experience. And so really, I think it comes down to the individuals, who you are as an individual, and then who you are as a partnership, as a collaboration team, because I think the process might vary or differ based on those factors.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about getting ego out of the way, and no writer can be an island, but yeah, that's a, you know, when the editor chops at you, it's like, yeah, that's your job, book coach. But to be able to have a peer, just being like, this is awful. Where'd this come from? We should change it. It might take some.
Well, when you say, when you talk about editing, people like self-editing, people say, hey, you have to be willing to kill your darlings. Right. Oh, yeah. And for the people out there that don't know what that means, it basically means you may have written a very beautiful, incredibly eloquent phrase or piece of dialogue or description or whatever, but if it doesn't work for the story, you've got to cut it. Now, I'd always advise you to save it so you can use it elsewhere, but you got to cut it if it's not best for the story. That's called killing your darlings. Well, it's one thing to kill your own darlings. It's another thing to have somebody murder them by the side of the road, you know? And so that's where you got to check that ego. Like you said, you have to be willing to accept it and to also believe that the person has the best interests of the book at heart. And I've been fortunate because every time I've collaborated with someone, that has been the case. When I collaborated with Eric Buettner, I had to hound him for, I think, years, if I recall, to work together, because I love the guy and I admire the hell out of his writing. And I wanted to work with him, and he kept saying, no. And after my feelings were hurt or whatever, and I was like, you know, why not? You know? And he's like, look, I already did this once. I collaborated and I had a really good experience. I don't think there's any, that's like winning the lottery. I don't think there's any way that can happen again. And I don't want to mess up a friendship by doing it. And I was like, well, you know, that's fair, but I still kept after him about it for a little bit and stalked him about it, you know, every so often. And finally he reached out to me and he said, hey, I got this idea and it might actually work as a collaboration. Maybe we'll give it a shot. And then we did. And it was great. I've been very fortunate in that regard. I think collaboration has a lot of minefields, or a lot of mines in the minefield that you could step on, even not purposefully. So, well, I guess why would you step on one on purpose?
Yeah. Right. Well, persistence pays off. That's for sure on that one. We started talking about Ride Along and went right into universe building and kept right on going, but I don't want to ignore All That Life Requires, the Jack McRae.
Yeah, that's a sequel that was almost a decade in the making. I wrote a book called At This Point in My Life back in 2012 or so. I think it was published in 2013. And it featured a guy named Jack McRae, who was a police detective. And I wouldn't call him milquetoast exactly, but I would call him very average. You know, I mean, he worked property crimes his whole career. He never had a huge case. He never, you know, I mean, if he made the papers, it was below the fold or in page six inside sort of thing. He just didn't have a stellar career, but it was a solid career. But it wasn't stellar. And, you know, he doesn't have family, you know, no siblings, parents are gone. And so when he finally retires at 57, you know, he's kind of at that point in his life where he's wondering, what kind of mark am I going to leave on the world? You know, is anybody even going to know that I was here? And then after he's been retired for a month or so, he'd gotten a message the day or two before he retired, and the person eventually follows up. And it turns out to be a girl who's now a woman who he had lived with her mom for about a year, many, many years ago. And she was about 10 at the time, and it didn't work out, and they broke up, and that, you know, that was that. And now she's reaching back out to him because her mom has died, and in her things, she has found a photograph of her mom and a four or five-year-old girl sitting on her lap. That is a spitting image of her mom, very clearly a daughter, or at least that's what she thinks, and not her. So she's like, I think I have a sister. And then a little bit of cocktail math tells him that could also be his kid. And the downside to it is her relatives, her mom's parents, are down in a small town in Oregon, and they kind of have that town in an iron grip, is one of those sort of situations. And they're not talking. And she's like, I need some help. I need somebody who understands how to investigate or whatever, talk to people, and I'm getting nowhere. Would you help me? And he agrees to, partially because he wants to help her and partially because this could be his daughter. And so they go down to Oregon, and there's a mystery there. And that mystery is resolved and ends. And I thought it was a standalone and it was done. And then about 9 years later, I realized that Mac, Jack McCrae, Mac wasn't quite finished, and he had another couple of books in him. And so All That This Life Requires, it came out in June, and he's aged in real time. So he's another 9 years older now, and kind of lonely, and he's, you know, senior citizen basically. And his mentor, who you get to know a little bit in the first part of the first book, dies. And his son, the mentor's son, comes to him and says, hey, I found this letter. I know you looked up to my dad. You thought he was the greatest person and the greatest cop in the world, but I found this letter that kind of sounds like he's vaguely confessing to have done something wrong. And I want to know what that is. I want to understand what it is. And so that sets Mac on a kind of a journey to figure out what is this guy talking about in this letter that he left his son. And the book really explores the concept of the three kinds of justice that exist in the world. The idea of do the ends justify the means? Yeah. Was somebody treated justly in the process? Now I'm embarrassed. I'm forgetting the third one. I taught this. This is part of the leadership program. I taught the three types of justice. Distributive justice was. Was the process fair? How was the person treated during the process? And does the punishment fit the crime? Those are the lay person ways of describing it. And the big question here for Mac is, if somebody who is a very bad person, who absolutely, without a doubt, did a very bad thing that pretty much everybody on earth would agree is a bad thing, if he got put in jail in a way that was not just, the process was not just, then, you know, was justice served?
It was justice served, yeah. Yep.
Right? And so it becomes a question that he and some other people have to ultimately answer. And so that's what All That This Life Requires is about. And then there'll be a third one here probably sometime late next year. So that at least to be a trilogy of Jack McCrae private investigator novels.
I can see a lot of tension in that one. I like it. I can't wait to dive into it. So you, 40 and counting. How many books do you put out a year?
It's varied from year to year. I've had some, bumper crops, and then I've had some slower years, depending on what was going on in my life aside from writing. I mean, 40 sounds like a lot, and I mean, it is. Whenever I get down about, I'm not on the New York Times bestseller list or whatever, everybody has self-doubt, right? Whenever I fall prey to that. I sometimes, you know, tell myself, well, you've written 40 books, you know, and if you go on Amazon, they're all above 4 stars, some of them closer to 5. So obviously you should feel good about yourself. Right. But 40, big number, but then again, you got to remember the first book came out in 2006. Yeah. And you have to remember that I'd have to guess, but I'd say between 15 and 20 of them, say 16, 17 at least, are co-authored. And so that's maybe 3/4 of a book effort-wise, right? I mean, you write half of it about, but you edit all of it and you do all the, you know, 100% of every other stage of it. But having collaborated on 15 or 18 of them, you know, has upped my output considerably. I always found it easier if I was working on, say, a River City book by myself, I could actually work on a collab work at the same time because that had a different rhythm to it. I don't do that anymore. I work on one book at a time, even if it is a collaboration, but I'm really only collaborating with Colin at this point. So I put that work first and I don't work on anything else. But till 5-7 years ago, I was able to work on more than one at once. It just had a different feel to it for me. So it becomes less impressive numbers wise when you break it down. You go, okay, wait, how many is that a year? If you do 2 a year, are we there? You
know, I mean, 40,
2 to 3 40 a year books, and you're there.
40 books in all is impressive enough. I think, you know, we don't need to get into the equations. That was just, but 40 books straight. I mean, that's impressive. That's some output. But we've been going about an hour and I don't want to keep you too long on a Tuesday night, but before I go, given, you know, your time you spent in the Army, time you spent in the PD, what kind of advice would you have for somebody, you know, either trying to figure out which recruiter's office to walk in or whether or not to go to the police academy?
Well, those are two very different questions, I think. On the recruiter side, I would say have an idea what kind of job you want to work at. Hopefully pick one that has a civilian application in case you decide not to make a career out of the military. And so when you go into that recruiter's office, pick the branch of service that is best at that job. I mean, if you want to be an infantryman, then join the Army or the Marine Corps. If you want to be a pilot, you know, I mean, I don't want to offend anyone, so I won't say Air Force necessarily, but you get my point, right? You don't join the Army and want to be on a ship. I mean, it's just not, you know, pick the service that is best at whatever job it is you want to do or has the best opportunities for you, and know what's available to you, find out what's available to you and get the best deal you can. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get the Army College Fund when I went in. I have, you know, a bachelor's degree because of that. I mean, that helped with that immensely. So definitely do your research before you go in so you know the right questions to ask, because the recruiters aren't going to try to screw you like they used to. I mean, I don't think they do anymore. But everybody's a human being and recruiters are faced with the same kind of external pressures as anyone else. And if there's a particular field that is understaffed, it's critical, they're going to try to funnel people who qualify into that field, even if it's maybe not the best fit for you on other levels. And so know what you want and then go get it. Take somebody with you, take your parent or friend or somebody who knows about the military with you so you get the best possible deal. And then don't be afraid to make a career out of it or not. It could go either way, right? Don't go in with an open mind to either option.
Yep.
Where law enforcement is concerned, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, in a way, know what kind of law enforcement you want to be involved in. That will help you decide whether to apply to a small town city police department or a large city police department or a large county sheriff's office or a federal office. You know, some federal agencies, you already need to have law enforcement experience to apply. So you may need to, do that first. But if you want to investigate bank robberies, you probably want to join, you know, eventually the FBI. If you want to do protection details, you might want to look at the Secret Service. If you, you know, want a slow pace or a fast pace, that might help you choose between Spokane or Cheney, you know. Just know what you want going to. And the thing is, as you well know in your position, as soon as you know that's a career field to get into, live your life appropriately. Yeah. Don't think you can be a, you know, idiot until you apply, and that's not going to come back to haunt you. It will. And then tell the truth about everything, because if you lie, you die. Yeah, you know, you'll get kicked out, you'll get removed from contention. Yeah. And it'll pop up in one way or another. Somebody knows everything you ever did. And even if they don't, the polygraph will get you, because it's physiological. And unless you're a nice person, then it's gonna pop up, you know. And then I guess the last thing I would say is, I mean, go into the field for the right reason. I mean, we used to joke about how much we love the job and we get to, you know, drive fast and chase bad guys and point guns at them and take them to jail. And, you know, I can't believe they pay me for this. And of course, then later in your career, like, they don't pay me enough for this. But, you know, why did you want to be a cop? You know, everybody says to help people, but it really should be to help people, to make the world a better place, and to be of a service mindset. If you can't go into law enforcement wanting to serve your community, then you shouldn't go in, because it's not the right field for you.
Yep. Yeah. And it's going to bite you too. When you don't come first when you're on a PD, you never come first, and the agency's not paid to love you back. So have the right reasons.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it completely frames how you approach everything.
Yep.
And you're right. It will come back to bite you, because you'll stop approaching things correctly at some point if you don't have that servant mindset. It doesn't mean you have to take crap from everybody and get, you know, be a doormat. I don't mean that. But your purpose for being there should be to serve.
Yep. Making the community better. Awesome. Well, I appreciate the time you spent with me tonight. And I've got, I'm usually really bad about remembering this, but I've got, you're on Facebook, IG at Frank Sfero 370, Twitter, Frank_Sfero, LinkedIn. That's a big handle. We'll go with Frank Scalise on that one.
That's right.
That's a big LinkedIn handle. And then of course, the website, franksfero.com. Actually, if you're looking to that, your website is organized really well. I mean, that's a,
oh, thank you.
The way you break out the series and the way you put up, it's the timelines and all the other resources. That website was really easy to navigate. But Frank, thanks for joining me tonight. I appreciate it. Anytime you want to come back, you know, the next five books you put out this year, feel free to come out and talk to me about them.
I'd be thrilled to do so. Thanks for asking some great questions. I've had a good time.
Good. I appreciate it. And thanks, everybody. Don't forget Blood Red Ivory. Thanks for all the comments and all the support. It's doing great. And I will talk to you guys next week.